This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's the season to protect yourself against the flu and also your dog against the flu. Cases of canine influenza are growing in the United States. A veterinarian joins us to talk about the virus and how you can protect your pet. Now, the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol held its final public hearing this afternoon and approved the final report on its investigation. The hearing included a vote to refer criminal charges against former President Donald Trump to the Justice Department. Here's Republican Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming summarizing some of the committee's findings.
This was an utter moral failure and a clear dereliction of duty. Evidence of this can be seen in the testimony of President Trump's own White House counsel and several other White House witnesses. No man who would behave that way at that moment in time can ever serve in any position of authority in our nation again. He is unfit for any office.
Prior to today's hearing, Trump posted on social media that the committee members were, quote, thugs and scoundrels who are, quote, corrupt cowards who hate our country. The referral for charges leaves the Justice Department with a historic decision of whether or not to criminally prosecute a former U.S. president. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to this afternoon's event? What did you think? Have you been following these hearings over the last year and a half or so? Do you support the referral of charges against former President Trump? Should the Justice Department charge him with some or all of the crimes they listed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. David Seemers is a professor of political science at UW Oshkosh. He's the author of several books and articles on the Constitution and the separation of power between Congress and the president. His most recent book is called The Myth of Co-Equal Branches, Restoring the Constitution's Separation of Functions. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, can you talk about these criminal referrals? I think the big outcome of today, on the one hand, they have no force of law. The Justice Department would have to decide whether or not to act on them. On the other hand, this is kind of unprecedented territory, symbolically important. What do you make of it all?
Yeah, well, first, what is a criminal referral? And it's just when officials who can't charge someone with a crime find credible evidence of a crime and want to turn that over to the authorities who actually can prosecute that crime. And this happens fairly frequently. If state officials, for instance, find someone has committed a federal crime, they'll turn over information to the federal authorities so that they can be charged with a crime or decide whether that happens. It happens all the time, but what's unusual about this is who's been, referred, right? Donald Trump, the former president, and for what? For actions that he took while he was president of the United States. So, I was trying to cast around for maybe some historical precedent, and I have a couple things in mind, but there is really nothing quite like it.
What is in the neighborhood of precedent? Because, yeah, I've been racking my brain, too.
All right. So in the United States, let's go back to 1974, and you have a special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, who is leading an investigation of the Watergate break-in and the associated cover-up. So that is on the executive side, but he's doing something that is kind of like a referral to Congress. He's saying to Congress, hey, the president was likely involved in a criminal conspiracy, and here are the charges that I would bring if I were the prosecutor. But you know what? He's the sitting president, and so you probably want to take a look at this first. And the clear implication from Jaworski is that the House committee should recommend impeachment, which it ultimately did, and that is what forced Nixon to resign. So that's a precedent in the United States. If we want to go way back in history, James I, monarch of England, 1642, is a kind of rogue monarch, according to people in the House of Commons. And he goes into the House of Commons in January of 1642, attempting to arrest five of their members on a charge of treason. He is rebuffed in this. The five members have been told to leave. And in the next few days, people in London are so incensed by what the king did that they kind of hound him out of town. And that's the beginning of the English Civil War. And ultimately, he's brought up on charges. And in 1649, that ends rather badly for James the First.
I think it was Charles the First. I'm an English Civil War nerd. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a lot to work with now. And there's been this question all along, like, okay, can a sitting president be charged with crimes, or can only Congress impeach the president? Well, how about a former president? There's the argument with the second impeachment, you can impeach a former president. So can you charge a former president with crimes? Where are we on all that right now?
Well, surely you can charge a former president with crimes. The only reason that a sitting president is not charged with crimes is because there's a Department of Justice memo saying that that's bad policy for the Justice Department. And you can see why, because the Justice Department is officially underneath the president. So it creates all kinds of potential conflicts of interest. And, you know, it's probably better from a governance perspective or a separation of powers perspective to wait until after a president is out of office. I mean, Donald Trump said it as well as anyone, I suppose, or posed a really interesting question when he said that maybe he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York and get away with it for a time. Perhaps, at least according to the Department of Justice, that could happen, though that's a state crime. And, you know, then you have a president perhaps being prosecuted by a state. But the president wouldn't get away with that in the long run, because the president is simply a private citizen after he leaves office.
We are talking to David Siemers from UW Oshkosh, looking at today's hearing, apparently final hearing of the January 6th committee in the U.S. House. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. The committee referred the former president to the Justice Department for a list of charges. Should former President Trump be charged? If so, with what? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Let's go to your calls. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Well, it finally wraps up. The committee's done. A couple of comments. I had, like many, many people, hoped Mr. Trump would have been successful, but it turned out that he essentially is a scoundrel, you know, and we don't need to have, you know, attorneys tell us that. We saw it with our own eyes as a country on January the 6th. First time in our country's history that that kind of action has ever occurred. So whether or not he is found guilty or how this plays out, I think that all of us need to be careful about any kind of approval or sanction of this guy as a future office holder. Well, and he'll go down in infamy. So that's it. That's all I have to say.
Well, thanks for that call. I mean, that follows up on what we heard from Representative Cheney there, saying that the former president is, quote, unfit for any office, unquote. Politically, even whether or not charges are filed, is our caller right that the message is out there?
Yeah, I think that's an important part of what the January 6th committee was doing, to lay out facts for the historical record. You know, whenever Congress acts or members of Congress act, it's not just about the good of the country. It's about politics as well. And I think, you know, Democratic members are probably also thinking of about politics. They can't help but do that. They're in that position. And so marginalizing Trump with a certain constituency, like the caller, who was maybe a voter in 2016 and maybe even 2020, and did not foresee the events of January 6th. There are a lot of people who have learned that lesson, and to keep the gas on that pedal is something that the January 6th committee was going to do.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to look at the charges they referred, the committee referred to the Department of Justice on President Trump, former President Trump. Here they are: obstructing an official proceeding, defrauding the United States, making false statements, and assisting or aiding an insurrection. What do you think of that list of referrals? One more than I think people had expected to come out of this.
it's a pretty serious list of criminal charges, right? Not official charges, as you said, but accusations, right? Based on the evidence that they found. Insurrection possibly carries with it the possibility of a 10-year jail sentence, also a disqualification from ever holding office in the United States again. The other ones are serious as well. The conspiracy to defraud has been, or obstructing an official proceeding has been used hundreds of times in the prosecution of January 6th insurrectionists or rioters. So if the people who actually listened to Donald Trump and kind of went to the Capitol and stormed the barricades were charged with that, it probably makes sense that someone, if they incited that person, would face that charge as well.
We're talking to UW Oshkosh political science professor David Siemers about the final January 6th public hearing this afternoon and the referral of criminal charges for former President Trump and others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's in the Department of Justice's hands now, a special counsel. Do you think former President Trump should be charged with a crime or crimes? If so, what? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with UW Oshkosh political science professor David Siemers with us today to talk about the fallout from the January 6th committee's final findings. They included a recommendation for criminal charges against former President Trump. Their full report expected to be released later this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Among those charges, as we just mentioned, the charge of insurrection. Here's Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland earlier today describing the seriousness of that charge.
It is a grave federal offense anchored in the Constitution itself, which repeatedly opposes insurrections and domestic violence, and indeed uses participation in insurrection by office holders as automatic grounds for disqualification from ever holding public office again at the federal or state level. Anyone who incites others to engage in rebelling, assists them in doing so, or gives aid and comfort to those engaged in insurrection is guilty of a federal crime.
Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Saul, hi.
Hey, how are you? A couple of things, just to be a nitpicker. He said he could stand in the middle of Broadway in broad daylight and shoot somebody. And depending on how far uptown you are in Broadway, that's a lot of people have done that. My comment was I had watched a clip on, I think it was CNN, of Adam Schiff talking about, the prosecution president, and he wondered at Justice Department's slow progress in its various actions against the president. And it occurred to me that I'm wondering if Merrick Garland is still considering he might be nominated to become a Supreme Court justice should something happen during Biden's term.
Saul, thanks for the call. David, the speed of the Justice Department investigation now in the hands of Special Counsel Jack Smith. I don't know if you agree with Saul's thoughts on Merrick Garland's potential future, but what do you make of the rate at which they've been doing these investigations?
Well, it's slow, but you don't charge a former president with criminal wrongdoing on the drop of a hat. It's really important that we not criminalize governance and be wary of doing so. I think that's one of the reasons for the slowness. I think that any violation that is charged criminally has to be pretty clear and readily understood by the public. And there will be many people who say that the president shouldn't be able to do anything criminal. And, in theory, that is a very important stance. In practice, it's a little bit more complicated. And if you start charging presidents with criminal wrongdoing, and you do that kind of immediately out of office, and you do so on technicalities or laws that are pretty obscure, then you're going down a path that a lot of countries have been down, and their citizens regret it. So slowness is okay at this point, I think. I would expect there to be criminal charges against the president, but that's just a guess. I would guess that they'd come out in the next couple months.
Thanks for the call, Saul. Kay joins us next in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to kind of obliquely address what the professor just said, but give a Lincoln precedent, but in reverse. During the middle of the war, Lincoln arrested or ordered arrest of a few newspaper publishers who opposed the draft. But not only did they just oppose it, they urged young men to desert. So Lincoln's response was, why should I not touch the hair on the head of a publisher when I am forced to decide which young men who deserted the Union Army to shoot? In other words, Lincoln's point was it's not just that they voiced opposition to the draft, but they urged action. So with Trump's Republican lawyers urging him to act to control, pull back the crowd, Trump made the decision not to act to control the crowd was an action.
I see. Kay, thanks for the call. And that's something that the committee members were making a point of, former President Trump's inaction while the crowd was in the Capitol, as in effect supporting that crowd. David?
Yeah, I mean, the Trump actions in the minds of the January 6th committee clearly go beyond dereliction of duty, right? Making bad decisions as president and go toward criminality. And I want to point out how extraordinary that is, because public officials have a lot of protections, not reputationally, obviously, but legally in the decisions that they make. And you have to really be egregiously criminal in order for to be charged with criminal behavior while you're in office and making decisions, or as the caller says, non-decisions that affect people.
Okay, thanks for that call. Aaron is with us now in Marinette. Aaron, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment, kind of a general comment. That even though there's a lot of national resentment and distaste towards Donald Trump as former president, to be certain that we still uphold the ideals of innocent until proven guilty, and that any charges that would be laid against him would be done because of the facts of the situation, not because of national sentiment or some type of emotional dislike for him as a person or how he operated as a president, and that any charges that would be pressed against him, you know, they really have to consider, would it lead to a true indictment? Is there any chance at all of actually finding him guilty?
Aaron, I gotcha. Some background noise there, but David, what do you think of Aaron's point?
Yeah, those are great reminders. If he becomes a defendant, which we don't know yet, he is afforded all the rights of any criminal defendant. I would say, to go back to the charges a little bit, that the fake elector attempt or scheme to kind of have alternate slates of electors are something that this committee was really looking at and thinking about when they formulated the charges. Now, the DOJ gets this, and, like, it doesn't do anything for them, right? They've gathered their own evidence. They're making their own decisions. And if anything, it puts them in a little bit of an awkward position. So I have faith that the DOJ is doing their job slowly and methodically, and we'll see where that goes.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And I mentioned the special counsel, Jack Smith. It seems like so far he's very much trying to not make himself a household name here. What are you watching for from him in the months to come?
Well, just a big news release someday, right? But if he decides not to prosecute or sends that recommendation on to Merrick Garland, well, it'll drop with a kind of thud, right? So Jack Smith is a very experienced prosecutor and has a terrific reputation for thoroughness, being methodical, being fair. So we'll see what comes out of that office in the next couple months.
And I wanted to mention former President Trump has announced he's running to be future President Trump. Does the fact that he's now an announced candidate who presumably would be running against the sitting president, does that influence the Justice Department's thinking or treatment on this?
I don't think it does. Merrick Garland has said that you dole out justice without fear or favor. I think, you know, practically, we as American citizens have to be sensitive to the fact and understand that there are millions of people who are very strong proponents of Donald Trump. That's not a reason not to charge him. That's not a reason to charge him. All that occurs on the basis of evidence. But in terms of politics and the fallout of this, we've got to understand that people are going to be really upset now if the charges actually materialize. Well, I'll just leave it there.
All right, David, and we will leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
All right, thanks. Good to be with you, Rob.
You too. That's David Siemers, professor of political science at UW Oshkosh, author of several books and articles on the Constitution and the separation of power between Congress and the president. He was with us today to recap what we heard in the final January 6th committee meeting this afternoon and where the investigation goes from there. Follow that news at WPR.org. Our colleagues at NPR, of course, are writing about that quite a bit today. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Missing people of color get less media coverage than white people do when they go missing. Kate and her guests look at some of the disparities in that coverage, where it comes from, and most importantly, the impact those disparities can have on efforts to solve these missing persons cases. Join the conversation, learn more. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. A couple weeks back, I shared the most common names for dogs in the United States, but sometimes it can be hard to tell if a name goes with a dog or a human. The Washington Post Department of Data looked at some big databases of dog and human names to answer the question, which names are more dog, more human, or a toss-up? Now forget Fido and other names that only go with dogs. They were looking for crossover names. Now here's some of the names that were equally dog and human. Jack, Angel, Cody, Hunter, Bruce, Joy, and Bonnie. But how about Max, Bella, Luna, Daisy, and Buddy? You can probably guess those are more common for dogs. George, Kevin, and Betty. Not super common for anybody anymore, but they're almost certainly going to be human and not dog. And the Post has a thing where you can enter names, see where they fall. I tried variants of my name. Robert, all human, all the time. Bobby, mostly human, but Rob and Robbie, it's a toss-up. Pretty sure I'm human. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, 25 indigenous artists from Wisconsin, around the U.S., and Mexico are exploring identity in an art exhibit in Appleton. We'll talk to the guest curator behind the project. You may be watching out for COVID, RSV, and the flu, but now there's another virus to watch out for, and it's one affecting our pets. Canine influenza is a respiratory illness that has cases rising this year. Some states are calling it an outbreak. Dr. Sandra Newberry is the director of the University of Wisconsin Shelter Medicine Program and assistant professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Newberry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you give us the basics on canine influenza? What is it? How is it affecting dogs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most basic thing people need to know about canine influenza is to not panic about it. Mm-hmm. The first time we saw canine influenza in the United States, this kind of influenza, which is called H3N2 canine influenza, was in Chicago many years ago, was the first introduction. And what we've seen since then is that that strain of influenza really died out. And now what we see is kind of new introductions that pop up. So it's not really that it's kind of spreading all over the country. It's more that it kind of pops up in different places. When it does pop up, it causes animals to get a respiratory disease that's often mild and sometimes more severe with coughing, but it doesn't usually cause very many animals to die. It's really uncommon that it would kill an animal and it's or a dog, and it's usually because the dog has some other underlying conditions too.
Can you talk about some of the outbreaks you've seen? I understand as part of the shelter medicine program, your program actually works with shelters and other places where we might have multiple dogs together around the country.
Yeah, and I mean, it turns into an outbreak because it's still a relatively novel pathogen. And everybody knows about this now because we've been through a pandemic with a novel pathogen. And so when it comes in, it will really spread because there's lots of animals that have never seen that virus before. And so they're not protected or immunized against it. And so when sometimes all it takes is, you know, one or two dogs to go into an animal shelter setting, and then we'll have an outbreak in the shelter. What we see more commonly, honestly, than animal shelter outbreaks is we see, like in a doggy daycare center, if one dog comes in or two dogs come in that were affected, then we'll see it spread there. And when we first saw the introduction, it was happening in daycares, it was happening at groomers, it was happening even in veterinary clinics in Chicago, until we knew more about the virus.
What are some symptoms that people can watch for, whether it's, my dog or I work at one of these facilities and I'm watching for it in dogs? What could give us a tip off that this might be canine influenza?
The problem is that it's going to look a lot like all the other kinds of respiratory diseases that dogs get when you see it. And so the best thing is, just like we all know to do now because of COVID, is that if your dog is sick, they shouldn't go to daycare. And if your dog is sick, they shouldn't be around other dogs. And so when you have clinical signs of respiratory disease, that's a great time for your dog. When your dog has those signs, that's a great time for your dog to stay home and not be around other dogs.
Something people might wonder about is, if I've got a dog at home, it's not exposed to other dogs, great. But what if I pet a dog or interact with a dog that turns out to have influenza? Can I bring it home to a dog? Is it that transmissible?
You know, just like other flu viruses, the flu virus isn't going to last very long on surfaces or on your hands. But of course, if you're a veterinarian who's, working with a sick dog and you didn't wash your hands and you didn't change your clothes, you could, of course, take that home to your own pet. But the likelihood of that happening is reasonably low. The thing to be aware of, too, is that we usually find that this moves from community to community. We don't have reports right now of this being in Wisconsin. We've been working with some shelters in Dallas, Texas that have had some problems with this. But even when we're doing testing in Dallas now, it looks like it's kind of moved out of the community pretty quickly. We're hoping that's true. We're sort of waiting and watching. So while it is something to be aware of, it's not something that we all need to, be kind of constantly worrying about.
And especially if you're in an area with an outbreak, is vaccination an option? And if so, who is it worth thinking about vaccination for?
So vaccination is an option. And really, if you want to have your animal, your dog vaccinated for canine influenza, the time to do it is before there's an outbreak. The vaccination is a 2-vaccine series. So they need to have the first vaccine and then wait about 3 or 4 weeks and then get the second. And this is, it's all so much easier to talk about this stuff now that we've been in a pandemic. So at least there's a couple good things that come from that. But the vaccine is much like COVID in that it'll reduce the shedding that dog would have. And it would usually reduce the clinical signs, but it won't prevent infection completely. So it's going to be a lot like what we've all experienced with the COVID vaccines.
And Dr. Newberry, if somebody has a dog who's having some kind of respiratory illness, as you say, the influenza is usually not too severe, what's some home care advice?
I mean, if your dog has an unexplained respiratory illness, in most cases, my advice is going to be that you should call your own veterinarian who knows that dog and knows their history, or take the animal in to see the veterinarian, because most dogs in a, you know, in a household setting shouldn't be developing respiratory disease. That would be uncommon. And if they got respiratory disease from going into doggy daycare, then you might want to find out, and you can do some diagnostic testing to just make sure it's not influenza or some other problematic thing. But it's, again, it's kind of like if a human has respiratory disease, most of the time, if it's not too severe, they're going to rest, and they may or may not need antibiotics depending on what's causing the respiratory disease. And then beyond that, it's going to be interventions that your veterinarian may or may not suggest.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Dr. Newberry, as you said, the influenza is not having outbreaks in Wisconsin now. Is there a place where, hey, if I'm in a job where I work with lots of dogs and I'm seeing lots of respiratory illness, do I report that to somebody?
I think anytime you're in a job and you're seeing a lot of respiratory disease in dogs, again, that some veterinarian should be aware of that. Or, you know, if you're in a doggy daycare center and all of the dogs are getting respiratory disease, for sure, that's something we should pay attention to. It's not normal for dogs to be developing respiratory disease. And so we want to respond whenever that's happening and figure out what we need to do differently in that environmental setting, or, you know, what kind of treatments those dogs need to get out of that situation.
Dr. Newberry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Dr. Sandra Newberry, director of the UW Shelter Medicine Program, associate professor in UW School of Veterinary Medicine, with us for a look at canine influenza and what you need to know about protecting your dog this season. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a mythical lumberjack and his ox.
We recently received a Wisconsin question from Ryan Urban of Rice Lake. He had a few questions about Paul Bunyan. Was he based on a real person? Did the tall tale begin in Wisconsin? And why is this legend still so popular? WPR's Jenny Peek set out to learn more about this flannel-wearing Northwoods lumberjack.
A job that needed a great big man, Paul Bunyan was the one.
Paul Bunyan stories are plentiful. He cleared forests with one swing of his axe. He and his trusty bovine, Babe the Blue Ox, dug the Great Lakes just to quench the thirst of his fellow loggers. He created the Mississippi River by simply dragging his axe behind him. He's a Wisconsin folk hero. But why? That's what Ryan Urban of Rice Lake wanted to know.
It's hard to travel around northern Wisconsin or Minnesota, Michigan for that matter, without seeing something Paul Bunyan related. And I guess I started to ask myself why.
I spoke with Michael Edmonds, a historian who researched and wrote the preeminent book on Paul Bunyan.
Paul Bunyan was, for decades in the last century, the best-known American folk hero. He was Thor. He was Ulysses. The first mention of Paul Bunyan's story being told dates to the winter of 1885-1886 in the town of Tomahawk.
Edmonds says the stories began as an oral tradition, passed down by loggers until the start of World War I in 1914.
In that oral tradition, Bunyan is one of the guys. He's a lumberjack. He might be a crew leader, but he's a tough working class guy. He's not very bright. He doesn't know how to read and write, but he's very, very strong, of course, very, very large, can solve many problems with brute strength.
Fast forward to 1915, the Red River Lumber Company in Minneapolis began an advertising campaign capitalizing on Paul Bunyan's popularity. The company shared the lumberjack stories in a catalog that was mailed to lumberyards across the United States.
And so Bunyan escaped the woods into the lumber industry as a whole. And the Red River Lumber Company was brilliant because, like the Grateful Dead, they allowed people to reproduce their products. They did not copyright these stories. And so they were seized upon by other publishers.
But as Paul Bunyan's stories transitioned from oral tellings to print, the tales changed.
When they were told out loud, it was lumberjacks trying to tease or fool one another. when they hit print, the audience was middle-class people who buy books. And in the end, by the 1950s, they only survive as children's books.
With my double blade axe and my hobnail boots, I go where the timber's tall. When there's work to be done, don't mess around, just sing right up or call.
And the tales are just that, stories. Edmund says there never was a real Paul Bunyan or Babe the Blue Ox.
There is no good evidence that there was anyone like Paul Bunyan. We want to believe in someone who can solve our problems, who's more powerful than we are as we face the challenges of life. And that was true for lumberjacks in the Wisconsin Northwoods in the 1880s and 90s, just like it's true for us today.
As for where Paul Bunyan hails from, well, that's here, in the Northwoods of Wisconsin.
Many, many states have claimed to be the birthplace of Paul Bunyan, but the only evidence that I could find places his birth, so to speak, not in Minnesota, but in north central Wisconsin. You know, this was nostalgia. This was an idealized, mythical frontier like the one they recalled from their childhoods. So 1915 to 1960, maybe, it's really easy to understand why the stories were popular. After that, I don't know.
Reasoning aside, it seems Paul Bunyan is here to stay, along with the rivers, lakes, and hills he's said to have created.
WPR's Jenny Peake brought us that story on Paul Bunyan. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talked to the guest curator behind an art exhibit in Appleton that looks at the complexities of Indigenous identity and tribal enrollment policies that govern it. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. An art exhibit in Appleton is exploring Indigenous identity through the work of 25 Indigenous artists from Wisconsin, around the U.S., and Mexico. It's called Reclaiming Identity. In it, the artists take on themes like colonization, borders, and the policies that govern tribal enrollment. Dakota Mace is a Diné or Navajo artist. She's a photographer and researcher at UW-Madison. She served as the guest curator of the exhibit, which runs through January 8th at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton. I talked to her about the project last Friday. This exhibit is called, as I mentioned, Reclaiming Identity. What does that idea, that theme, mean to you?
Yeah, so this was actually a bigger kind of inspiration in terms of looking at Indigenous identity, and especially for Indigenous artists, the way that we tell or share our stories in order to preserve not only our culture, but also our traditions. So Reclaiming Identity kind of fits into this larger theme of what does it mean to look at our identity through the complexity of blood quantum, but also kind of looking at bigger and broader themes of borders, family lineage, and shared histories.
Hey, you mentioned that phrase, blood quantum. I think for non-Native people, that may not be a familiar phrase. What is that, and why is it a theme you wanted to explore in this exhibit?
Yeah, so blood quantum for Indigenous people is a method of measurement that is used to determine Indigenous identity, either by their percentage or affiliation to a tribe. And this was implemented by the U.S. federal government in the 1900s, and today it's still something that many tribes continue to use within kind of determination, but for a lot of Indigenous people, especially for Indigenous artists, has kind of created a lot of complexity in terms of the response to, but also the conversation in terms of what does it mean to reclaim their identity, but also how can we push past this idea of blood quantum.
Can you give us a taste of some of the art we would see in this exhibit that tackles that issue?
Yeah, definitely. So we have a really amazing list of artists. We had over 25 Indigenous artists from across the U.S. and Mexico, and a couple of the artists that really kind of spoke to this idea of reclaiming identity was our recent series that focused on Isa Gargarin and Israel Campos, both who kind of explore identity through not only their community, but also looking at in terms abstracting that idea of what does it mean to be Indigenous and what does it mean to work within that realm, but also ways to give back to community, and especially for Israel's work, it was a chance to be able to explore his Chicano heritage and how that affects the Indigenous population, especially within LA.
We're talking to Dakota Mace about the new exhibit, Reclaiming Identity, at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton. It runs there through January 8th. Dakota, looking at the list of artists, people are representing a wide variety of tribal backgrounds, geographical backgrounds across the U.S. Why was it important to have that that broad, diverse array of artists involved?
Yeah, so my intention for kind of inviting these different types of artists from all across the country was a chance to be able to have the audience kind of be able to explore the different ways of indigeneity that is presented. And this is something that often a lot of museum institutions, as well as kind of more broader gallery institutions, really don't give a chance for their audience to kind of explore, is like the different ways that indigeneity is presented. And especially in Wisconsin, oftentimes we don't get to experience indigenous art that comes, you know, from Mexico or from the Southwest. So to be able to invite these artists and kind of open up a larger window of what does it mean to be indigenous and the different ways that our communities have really adapted and really challenged that way to present it within their works.
And that said, there is some Wisconsin work as part of the exhibit. Can you highlight the Wisconsin side of things?
Yeah, definitely. So a couple of artists within the exhibition, such as John Hitchcock, Tom Jones, Monty Little. Oh my gosh, there's so many names. Valeria Tateria. And I think one last one, Henry Payer, are all artists that are featured in the exhibition, but have either called Wisconsin home or currently living in Wisconsin.
Can you talk a little bit about the variety of styles of artwork, painting or sculpture or and textiles and so on? What kind of variety will we see when we walk through the door?
Yeah, so there is a big representation in terms of media within this exhibition. So when you come into the space, you are presented with paintings and photographs, but also textile work. And I wanted to be able to kind of have the audience experience these different ways of creating work, but also to kind of highlight the importance of these materials that a lot of these artists use. And especially on the second level of the gallery space, there is a focus more on traditional and non-traditional materials. And many artists played around with neon, such as John Hitchcock's work, or really explored traditional materials, such as the work of Michaela Payton, who utilized materials that come from her home and are connected to her tribe. So for a lot of these artists, it's a chance to be able to kind of push the materials themselves, but also kind of bring to light a better appreciation in terms of the way that their identity is translated through their work.
What are some of the things you like to explore in your own work as an artist?
So I work with a lot of materials as an artist. So I am trained as a photographer, but I do use a lot of textile and beadwork within my own practice. And that's something that I'm currently doing right now, is a combination of alternative photographic processes and beadwork, and eventually in the next coming months, combining that with textiles as well.
And I understand some of your work looks at ideas of cultural appropriation. What kind of things are you hoping to bring to people's attention?
Yeah, so that's something that I work with the University of Wisconsin-Madison through their design studies program, is that we are currently facilitating workshops through our textile collection, as well as through the program, to kind of bring this conversation and this issue in terms of the dialogue with cultural appropriation. So we invite students as well as community members to learn through these ideas of the importance and meaning behind appropriation, the kind of complex history behind it, but also to allow them to better understand what it means to work with those designs and designers.
Dakota, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Dakota Mace. She's a Diné or Navajo artist, also a photographer and researcher at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about an exhibit she guest curated for the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton, exploring Indigenous identity. The exhibit's called Reclaiming Identity. It runs through January 8th. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, motherhood was already challenging. The pandemic added a lot more problems and stress. We'll find out what changed with the author of the new book, Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Plus, from jobs to exercise to school, we're using games, points, and streaks as motivation. And that isn't always a healthy idea, according to the author of the new book, You've Been Played. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, could the age of the college essay be over? Our guest makes the case that AI-generated term papers are already here. The challenge is what to do about it in schools. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.